I'd like to welcome all of you. I'm Ann Solomon. I'm a senior advisor at CSIS for Technology Policy. And we have a great audience here this morning, and it's because the reliability of our critical infrastructure in the event of a global avian flu pandemic is now one of the primary concerns in Washington. Perhaps not quite as high up on the agenda as Iraq and Iran, but enormously important. I imagine a lot of you saw the business section of the New York Times this morning that had a front page article on avian flu and business preparedness for avian flu. I was pleased to read that the cartoon channel will continue to operate throughout a global pandemic, even though other businesses may be crippled by employee absences and transportation and communication disruptions. For the majority of the public, I suppose that continuity of operations and business in banking and financial services primarily means that they'll be able to continue to get those $20 bills out of their ATM machines. But this morning we'll hear from a number of key individuals who are working to ensure business continuity of the critical banking and financial services and who are wrestling with far more complex issues. I'm pleased to introduce our keynote speaker, someone whom most of you know, who will open discussions. Don Donahue serves as the chairman of the Financial Services Sector Coordinating Council for Critical Infrastructure Protection and Homeland Security, which I've learned is usually known as FISIC. Is that correct?
That's correct.
FISIC. Don also serves as the president of the Partnership for Critical Infrastructure Security, which is the organization of all sector coordinators under the Homeland Security Presidential Directive Number 7. In his spare time, Mr. Donahue serves as the chief operating officer for the Depository Trust and Clearing Corporation and as the president and COO of two of the DTCC operating subsidiaries, the Depository Trust Company and the National Securities Clearinghouse. We very much appreciate his coming down here this morning from New York to keynote these discussions. Don.
Thank you, Ann. And thank you all. Thank you all for attending this very important session this morning. I got an email from one of my co-panelists at, I think, somewhere around 7:30 this morning that said, make sure to read the front page of the business section of the New York Times, which I did, and I actually thought the article that ensued, the headline, was a whole lot more accurate than the headline was, and hopefully we will convey some of that to you today. The whole process of preparing the nation for the possibility of an avian flu pandemic is obviously a work in progress for the nation as a whole and is a work in progress for businesses as a whole and is a work in progress for the financial sector as well. But the fact that we cannot possibly be at the end point of knowing precisely what all preparations need to be deployed, and that is an impossibility today, given how many unknowns there are about how a possible, awful lot of possibilities showing up here, a possible pandemic might unfold, that it's totally unrealistic at this point to think that anyone would answer the question, are we fully prepared, with a yes. But what we are trying to convey this morning, and hopefully we'll very successfully convey this morning, is that the banking and finance sector is very actively moving forward to identify the issues associated with this possibility and to address those issues. And I think you will find that we have a very, very good story to tell along those lines. As we do that, or in preparation for our doing that, I think I need to give you a few minutes of introduction to the whole infrastructure protection issue, the organizations involved in that issue, and how that issue itself has evolved over the last decade, to really set the stage for talking about how that infrastructure protection effort is now going to be deployed to address the avian flu issue, and so I'm going to give you some intro on that as a beginning. I would suspect that there are very, very few people in the room who have ever heard the name PHYSIQ before, so I think we need to be clear about some of that right at the start. The National Critical Infrastructure Protection effort is something that has actually been underway since the mid-90s. It's been underway for a decade now. It is focusing on the reality that there are a number of sectors in the economy and in the society of this nation that are critical components of this nation's ability to continue to function and continue to act in a normal state. The responsibility for protecting those infrastructures is now currently on an overall basis resting with the Department for Homeland Security. In many of the sectors, there is an agency of the government specifically directed to have that responsibility for that sector. These are some of the sectors that are identified as critical infrastructures. There are actually 17, including the ones that you see on the slide in front of you, and they pretty much cover the gamut in terms of the essential services that people need to be able to continue to conduct their lives and the essential services that the economy needs to be able to continue to operate. Specifically for banking and finance, Treasury, and actually very much in the person of Scott Parsons, has the direct responsibility for monitoring infrastructure protection efforts with respect to the banking and finance sector, and works very closely with a working group referred to or known as the Financial and Banking Information Infrastructure Committee, pronounced FIBIC, so that you know what that acronym is, which is essentially all of the regulators involved in financial services, and really all of those people will come together in the form of the FIBIC to talk about and address issues that arise with respect to infrastructure protection. Critical infrastructure protection is, you know, very formidable-sounding phrase, but we need to be very clear about what that means, and certainly a preliminary part of the sector's effort in thinking about this issue was to take that down a level and, okay, let's talk specifically about what that is and what exactly that entails. What is the infrastructure that we're talking about here? What parts of that infrastructure are critical? What do we mean when we say we have to protect the critical infrastructure? What exactly does that entail? And who are the parties who actually have to do that? Don't assume that all of those answers are immediately obvious. They are things that really have to be thought through. They are, in fact, issues that have been very successfully thought through over the 10 years that we've been focused on this. We have many, many of the answers to them. I'm not going to spend a whole lot of time on this, but the essential theme here is that each of the components of banking and finance have to be broken down into tiers, and you have to focus on what are the issues with respect to those tiers and how do you protect those tiers? How do you prioritize them? Which are the ones you focus on first? Which are the ones you focus on next? What are the needs each of those tiers has? And how do you go about making sure that the institutions in each of those layers can continue to operate regardless of what the circumstances are? In the essential model that you will find in banking and finance, we represent it as a pyramid here. The more useful graphical image is to think of this in terms of rings of concentric circles, is that you have core infrastructures in the sector that handle tasks that must go on whatever the circumstances. They are typically how you handle payments, how you settle financial transactions, and how you maintain records with respect to payments and settlements that have occurred. You have other core infrastructures that set up transactions that first layer handles, settles, takes care of. The example on the security side would be the trading markets, and there is a layer there. Then you have all of the users of those infrastructures, and you differentiate among them as well, because there are firms that represent a substantial part of a particular financial market. The rule of thumb is someone who does 5% of the activity in a particular market is viewed as being a significant component of that market. Essentially, if you throw a party and that person doesn't show up, you're going to have a problem, because that is a that's a serious amount of market involvement that you need to have at the table. And then you move out into additional layers, which are people that collectively represent an important part of a particular financial market, but in their own individual capacities represent a lower transaction volume, represent a lower number of customers, whatever the metric is that you're measuring. And you're saying the infrastructure protection focus on that layer is at a lower level of intensity. Okay, the system as a whole could survive that person not operating as part of the system for a period of time, and that's the approach we've taken. This illustrates how you do that tiering on the investment side. This is how you do the tiering with respect to banks. You have payment systems. You have wholesale payment systems, you have retail payment systems, and you have the users of those systems, and you have a similar architecture with respect to insurance. That's an intra-sector view. There is also the very critical issue that each of the national sectors, in many serious respects, depends on the continued operation of some of the other sectors. The example in banking and finance we always use is that telecommunications is critical for banking and finance. If the telecommunications capability of the nation is knocked out, banking and finance essentially can't operate. And, of course, those of you who are familiar with the actual events in banking and finance on September 11th will know that it was a failure of the telecommunications environment that necessitated the trading markets to close for the week. It wasn't the trading markets themselves. They were perfectly able to operate. It was the fact that the telecommunications network in Lower Manhattan had been so damaged that people couldn't get orders to the market. That's what caused them to make the decision to close. And other parts of the sector, including the payment and settlement part that I represent, were able to continue operating without missing a beat during that entire week. So that's a very good illustration of this cross-sector dependency issue that's very relevant here. The difficulty that infrastructure protection presents is that, you know, any of the documents you look at will tell you that 85% or more of the infrastructures that the nation needs to protect in each of these sectors are in private sector hands. They are not national infrastructures. They are not governmentally owned infrastructures by and large. They are actually private companies that operate particular key components of the infrastructures pretty much in all the sectors. So the national plan says we need two instrumentalities to help marshal the private sector to deal with this. We need a sector coordinating council in the sector that addresses the issue on a policy level. What are the key priorities for the sector in proceeding on this effort? And we need what the documents refer to as an information sharing or analysis mechanism, which is how do you communicate within the sector about this issue? How do you send out alerts? How do you send out, you know, we have information that indicates there's a terrorist threat against certain financial institutions, the issue we faced 18 months ago. How does that information get out to the sector? And you have a mechanism that is responsible for doing that. In banking and finance, those two organizations are the Financial Services Sector Coordinating Council, or FSSIC, which handles the policy setting issues for banking and finance. In the Financial Services Information Sharing and Analysis Center, which handles the information sharing aspects of the responsibility, both of them operating under the aegis of Treasury and operating very closely with Treasury as our sector-specific agency. FSSIC is essentially a parallel organization to FBIC. FBIC is on the left. FSSIC is on the right. FSSIC is composed of entirely of private sector organizations. We have many banking and finance trade associations. We have key banking and finance infrastructures involved in this policy setting exercise as well. And FSSIC has a number of priorities and a number of initiatives that it has underway to address various components of the infrastructure protection issue with respect to banking and finance. You see them listed there. We think one of our key responsibilities is to make sure that the world knows what actually is going on. Okay, the banking and finance sector has an incredibly impressive story to tell in this space. But if the tree falls in the forest and isn't able to tell people that it fell, nobody knows. So what we've tried to do is also make very clear how much energy goes into this and what has been accomplished in this space. And you see illustrated there is a copy of an annual report that we issued this week. We actually are hoping they're somewhere in the hands of Airborne at the moment. We're hoping they're going to arrive here before the conference ends this morning so that we can give you copies of the annual report. If not, you can see it on the PHYSIC website, which is identified on the slide. As we've implemented all of these instrumentalities to deal with the infrastructure protection issue, the whole concept of infrastructure protection itself has evolved over that same time frame. 1998, you know, was the first time I had ever heard the words infrastructure protection, okay? Banking and finance has been doing continuity of operations since somewhere in the 1300s, okay? Banking and finance has been dealing with business continuity, has been dealing with security issues since the first banks were created. We were doing infrastructure protection at the time. Jesse James did the Great Northfield, Minnesota raid. Okay, we just didn't call it that. This is an issue that we have a lot of, have paid a lot of attention to and have a lot of experience with. But it has really morphed in very significant ways over the last few years. And I think that's important when you start talking about how avian flu, how we are going to be addressing the avian flu issue. If you went back 10 years ago and talk to people about continuity of operations or talk to people about business continuity, you would hear a view that was very location-focused, okay? I operate in this location. If something happens in this building, that's the problem that I've got to deal with. I have a fire in my data center. How am I going to recover from that? You had a very physical disaster-focused attention. It was fires in data centers. That was the kind of thing that people planned for. You also had, it was very common at that point to have, I can come back in 2 days and that's acceptable. Okay, a lot of people outsourced. Even in the core components that I described earlier, we relied on outsourced arrangements where we'd go to a disaster recovery vendor and recover in their space a day and a half, 2 days later. And that was considered state of the art 10 years ago. The year 2000 issue, the millennium bug, if you can cast your minds back to that particular delightful exercise we all went through, that was when the whole way that people were thinking about this began to evolve. Issue number one, it drove home very, very clearly the performance of information technology systems is critical to the ability of banking and finance to operate. Y2K, of course, was a cyber issue. It wasn't a physical issue. It also really underscored the network issue, okay, that if I'm fine but my counterparty is not able to operate, there's no point in me being fine, okay, that we began to understand that the sector functions as a network and the health of the network and the health of each other was a critical part of the business continuity strategy that every organization had to be focused on. One of the things you saw evolving in banking and finance as a result of this is a very, very collaborative approach to dealing with these issues. There is no financial institution that believes that it gets a competitive advantage from how well it does business continuity. Every institution understands when I learn something, I have to share that knowledge with everybody else because their health is just as important as my health when I'm dealing with business continuity. I need that guy to trade with. I need that guy to make payments to me. You know, I need that guy to be able to continue to conduct my own business operations. September 11th graphically demonstrated those issues. It graphically demonstrated that not having someone else in the system presented just as much of an issue to me as my potential inability to operate. It demonstrated the interdependency issue as we talked about. The loss of telecommunications was what the problem really was in those days. And it also changed the shift. It got away from this one location issue. We understood that regional disasters can be the issue even when a particular location is fine. My own company was fine. right? We never had an issue on September 11th, even though we were a few blocks from the Trade Center site. Our issue was what was happening to all of our members and their ability to continue to interoperate with us. So it was very much a regional issue, and it brought that focus to the table for the first time. The response to September 11th emphasized dealing with a lot of those issues. The core organizations, my own and others, said we have to begin dispersing our data processing capabilities. We have to begin developing DP capabilities outside of a particular region so that we do not have a dependency on a particular region. And we've done that, and many other financial firms have done that. We have to develop out-of-region business operations capabilities so that if something happens in a particular region, we can continue to operate by just shifting to another location and operating from that location. That also has been very successfully addressed by many financial firms. We all implemented much more extensive work-from-home capabilities. Okay, people could interact and conduct their business lives from someplace other than their offices. And my own organization, for example, has a rule that members of the executive team can never be present in the same place at the same time. One member of the exec team always has to be off-site, operating from home or somewhere else, so that if something happens in the location where we are, that person is still around to be able to continue the operation of the organization. That effort has been very, very successful. That effort has focused on the core and layers, the significant layer, as I referred to it, and the core layer to ensure the payment systems can continue to operate, to ensure that the markets can recover very quickly and continue to operate, and to ensure that the significant participants in those markets can continue to operate regardless of what the circumstances are. The events after 9/11 have, we believe, we know, validated the success of that strategy. The Northeast blackout in 2003, the hurricanes in 2005 made very clear that the regional dispersion strategy was very, very successful. The lights were out in New York. Our business centers and our data centers located outside of New York were able to continue in operation without missing a beat. It illustrated the success of the financial sector's collaborative response to this. And we have a mechanism in place where people gather on conference calls very quickly when something happens and exchange information about state of health, ability to operate, and so forth. And those mechanisms all worked perfectly in the Northeast blackout very effectively at 1 in the morning, 3 in the morning, 4 in the morning, 5 in the morning, having been on all those calls. They worked very well, and people were able to interact very successfully at that time. It underscored the cross-sector dependency issues. Obviously, the issue in Katrina, financial services recovered very fast. Telecommunications took time. Power took time. And we really are very focused on the need to address those issues as well. It also underscored that local issues are no longer local issues. One of the interesting learnings from Katrina was that people were could not, it wasn't so much Katrina, Rita and Wilma were the ones that really underscored this issue. People needed to know what the response in on the Texas coast and in southern Florida were. What were the localities doing? Are they limiting movement? Are they shutting areas down? Are they evacuating people? Because we all have offices, we all have conceivably processing centers in those locations, and we need to know nationally what's being done so that we have a full picture, and it's not something that we need to know what Florida's doing in terms of closing down facilities, for example, in response to a hurricane. That's something that nationally needs to be known, because most major financial institutions are now at minimum national institutions, if not global institutions. So how does avian flu change this? Regionally dispersed facilities are great. They handle regional disasters very effectively. If the issue you are dealing with is something that is region agnostic and can occur in multiple regions at the same time, there obviously we have no assurance that in our case our Tampa facility is going to be unaffected while our New York facility is affected, or vice versa. avian flu is something that can impact both facilities. So this regional dispersion that we've very successfully done does not deal with this issue in and of itself. Avian flu poses a longer duration challenge, okay? Our business continuity strategies in banking and finance are very focused on surviving a reasonably limited period of time, okay? In New York, we were knocked out of our office for the week of September 11th. On Monday, September 17th, we were back. We had to operate for 4 days under emergency conditions, but we were able to return to something approaching normality, aside from the smell, on Monday, September 17th. Okay, business continuities are dealing with relatively confined timeframes. Avian flu, as you well know, is going to be elongates that timeframe quite a bit. You're talking about a wave of infection that could be on the order of 6 to 8 weeks, I believe, is the estimate. You're talking about multiple waves of infection being possible, so that you have you have a serious problem for 2 months. You come out of that problem, and then you have another wave that could hit you several months thereafter, and you have to basically go back into emergency mode. So business continuity plans have to evolve to address those challenges. I will tell you that evolution is well underway, notwithstanding the New York Times this morning. This issue is drawing a lot of attention among the core financial components, the significant financial firms with respect to the tiering that we talked through earlier, the collaborative capabilities that we have worked out over the last 10 years and tested in multiple situations over the last 10 years are operating very effectively to respond to this issue. You all have in your packets from this morning a document that the FISIC issued 2 months ago, I believe, reflecting the first fruits of that collaborative sharing of information within financial services. That's working very well. And the PCIS that Ann mentioned, which is the cross-sector organization, is also very effectively sharing information across sectors about what kinds of preparations are going on. There is an electric sector document on what they're doing in relation to the potential for pandemic flu. There is a nuclear sector document, what they are doing in relation to pandemic flu. There's materials the telecommunications sector has prepared, what they are doing in preparation for pandemic flu. The food and agriculture sector is developing a document on what they are doing. All of those documents are being made available and shared so that people understand what's happening and also understand the implications for Sector A of what Sector B is doing, and we'll talk about that in a minute. Let's talk briefly about a few of the details. The issue of remote business operations centers. Today, everybody kind of operates collaboratively, certainly in emergency situations. Again, in a pandemic flu situation, if one were to develop, you can't do that. You have to develop discrete organizational units that need to be functioning on their own and need to essentially be walled off from each other so that you are containing the possibility of people spreading a particular infection. The term of art that's evolved is social distancing. That's what people are doing. So you're developing teams that are essentially going to be operating in different locations and essentially not interacting with each other so that you're minimizing the opportunity for an infection to spread among your employees. And people are developing plans on how to do that. Telecommuting is going to become a much more heavily utilized capability. Some of the securities firms, for example, are figuring out how to have their traders trading from home. Do you move trading turrets into somebody's house so that he can be trading from his living room so that he never has to interact with his counterparts? He's doing that all electronically. All that work from home strategy is certainly something that every institution is trying to figure out how to build into its business recovery plan. One of the decisions that we made in, you know, business continuity version 2.0, one of the things people do is you shut down what are viewed as non-essential areas, okay? Reconciliation functions, for example, you suspend when something like this goes on, because you say, I'll dig out a week from now, right? Reconciliation problems will always be there. So you say, I'm going to take those people and use them for production operations and defer doing that, and I'll deal with that a week from now or 2 weeks from now when the emergency is over. Obviously, in the event of an avian flu pandemic, you can't do that, okay, because the timeline you're talking about is longer. Some of those operations that you thought you would suspend, you have to resource. The clear example, which we'll talk about in a minute, HR people are automatically moved into production operations today. In a pandemic situation, you're going to need them monitoring absenteeism rates. You're going to need them monitoring health issues for your employees. So, again, you can't suspend that function, and your plan has to figure out how are they going to be able to continue to operate. Every plan that I'm aware of is assuming that people will be grounded, okay, that we are not going to have people traveling. We are not going to be allowing people come visit our office. Customers come in, which obviously routinely happens. We suspend all that stuff. Our people are not going to be traveling. Certainly, as we get indications that particular regions of the globe are starting to see something that looks might have migrated from, you know, stage three to stage four, you will be suspend. You can expect that people will be suspending travels to locations where there appears to be more, you know, more potential of exposure to something, and you will certainly see that as part of people's hands. Ongoing monitoring of absenteeism is something that you're seeing built into people's plans. Circulation of absenteeism stats to senior managers is something that people are working out how they're going to do that. Whether you're going to have a dashboard that shows absenteeism rates, as an example, is something that people are thinking through. And there's a whole set of issues that relate to interdependencies. And the example that everyone is using is, you know, the telecommunications networks are operating today in an environment where maybe 5 to 10% of people who work are roving workers and are relying on long-distance logging on to their home systems through the telecommunications network. If that number gets multiplied by X, you now have a third of everyone working from home. What does that mean in terms of the telecommunications network's ability to sustain that kind of sharp rise in volume? That's an example of an interdependency issue that people are trying to think through. We have pretty clear advice from the telecommunications network folks that the core networks are going to be able to sustain that with no problem. The issue is the last mile, where your person is working from. How can they log on to the core network through their local provider? Do they have what is needed to be able to do that? And if they do, that kind of volume surge, the telecoms folks are telling us, would certainly be able to be sustained by the network, which is the answer, obviously, we're hoping to hear. Another example is the local transportation issue. Every one of you knows that in the event there is a serious pandemic flu outbreak, people will think twice about getting on the metro trains to come in the morning, right? So how are we going to deal with those kinds of transportation issues? Do we need to think through our own ability to move people around? Do we need to change people's commuting patterns by having them operating from different locations? Do we want to have more people working from home so that we're not exposing them to that potential? Very big responsibility on staff communications. Okay, one part of pretty much every plan is much higher levels of education of the staff about hygiene and health best practices. Getting down to how you wash your hands, right? Getting down to think twice about shaking people's hands when they come to meetings. We were talking earlier whether we were going to give you a best practices by rubbing elbows among the panelists when we came up here. But those kinds of things you're going to have to communicate to your staff about, because obviously preventing the infection from spreading is the best way of is the best part of the plan. How do we communicate with local emergency organizations? How do we get information about local steps such as quarantines that are going to have a national impact? Okay, if the city of Houston decides to quarantine people or decides to declare, you know, what in the Northeast we would refer to as a snow day. I don't know what you call it down in Houston. Only essential people are able to drive, right? nationally, we need to know that. Okay, we need to know, gee, you just shut down my office by declaring a quarantine or by declaring a snow day. And how that information is going to be circulated nationally is an issue that we've actually raised with DHS specifically, because we think that's a role they're going to have to play. Clearly, there's also a role on the regulatory side about communicating both domestically and internationally. We have to have the regulators operating consistently on the same issues, okay? If capital relief, as an example, is given in one location, it has to be done consistently across other locations. A lot of health and safety issues that we have to focus on, principally dealing with the issue of getting valid information. We all know the minute evidence of human-to-human transmission becomes clear, the hysteria that will become evident in the media, it's going to go straight through the roof, okay? We need to be able to get access to sober and reliable information to be able to counsel our people about realistically how they should be thinking about and realistically what measures they should be putting in place. And then obviously there are the X factors. What kind of stresses would a pandemic impose? What's the market reaction going to be when this information gets out? What kind of risk issues does that present? What kind of stresses on your risk operation does that create? Depending on how virulent this virus is, that may increase absenteeism rates, not so much because people are sick, but because they don't want to come to work because they don't want to expose themselves. And again, when you have the press saying the death rate is 50%, you're helping get people very hysterical about this. Clearly not a positive thing to do. And the issue I mentioned earlier, uncoordinated responses from local authorities are going to be a problem for the sector as well. I would say very clearly that among the core firms, among the significant firms, very, very serious planning efforts are well underway. I would be surprised to hear there are exceptions in that layer of the sector, although Ken, I know, believes there are some. The coordination is well underway. The industry organizations, PHSIC and others, are doing a lot of best practice sharing among themselves already. Financial sector guidance has already been distributed, and I view that as version one. I'm sure there will be more guidance in future, and you have a copy of that in your materials. As I mentioned, cross-sector sharing of best practices is already in process. There's quite a bit of dialogue going on between PHSIC and the FIBIC members on this panel, and we are sort of going almost to the second generation of planning, okay? We've said and we believe that we think one thing the government needs to do is to come out with a consistent and rational set of planning assumptions, okay? We've all heard absenteeism assumptions that are all over the lot, you know? The only limit is 100 because you can't have more than 100% of your people out. But we're hearing numbers that are 20, we're hearing 30, we're hearing a third, we're hearing 40, we're hearing 50. We need something that says, look, let's get a consistent set of baseline assumptions that people can then, because that will make our plans then comparable across firm, because the next issue is going to be, I need to know what your plan is, and I need to know, are you doing things that are consistent with what I'm doing so that I can be reasonably confident that you're going to be there as a counterparty? And we are working through the possibility of a tabletop exercise within the sector to start that process of sharing plans across institutions, which we would hope would happen in the coming months. So those are some of the examples. And Anna, do you want to step up now? Okay.
Thank you very much, Don. We're going to forego questions and answers till the end of the session. Greg Gist, do we have Greg here from? Oh, good. Come on up here, Greg. Maybe we have time for one question as Greg is taking his seat for Mr. Donahue. Anybody have a question?
How could they possibly?
Pretty complete. That was superb. Yes. We have a...
never hear the question.
Said that they wouldn't share their plans with other
the question was, some people in the New York Times article this morning suggested that some firms were not sharing their business continuity preparedness plans. And do you know anything about that?
Well, I believe, actually, I'm not sure. Was that a financial firm that said that? Does anybody remember? I'm not sure whether it was a financial firm that said that or not. I would tell you that it is SOP within banking and finance that people share this kind of information at pretty detailed levels, okay, because there are industry groups that are expressly put together to get into this kind of detailed information sharing. And again, it is very clear to everyone in the sector that I need you in operation, right? This is not a competitive issue at all, okay? I trade with you. If I can't trade with you, you know, that's a business problem for me. So people do understand very clearly, and I think there is a longstanding tradition that on business continuity issues, people get pretty open about what kinds of steps they're taking and what kinds of things they're doing, okay? I would not be surprised if there are some areas where people don't want to get into specifics, but as a general rule, they're pretty forthcoming as to what specific what kinds of steps people are taking. That's not characteristic of banking and finance.
We have on the panel this morning people that are on the front lines from government and from the private sector. Our moderator for the panel is Ken McGee, who is vice president and a fellow at Gardner Incorporated, whom many of you may know as well or know his writings. And we have Scott Parsons, who's deputy assistant secretary of the Treasury for Critical Infrastructure Protection and Compliance Policy. Alton Harvey, who is Chief Officer of Continuity Planning, Division of Market Regulation for the Security and Exchange Commission. And Steve Malfres, who is Staff Director for Management of the Federal Reserve Board. And in your packet, you will also see an announcement that came out yesterday from the Federal Reserve Board system. We have two people who are really have a key responsibility in their firms for their preparedness plan. Jerry Komisar is Senior Vice President, Global Risk Assessment, the Business Information Group of AIG. And Greg Gist is the Senior Policy Advisor, Office of Business Continuity at Citigroup. I'm going to turn the discussion over to Ken, who will moderate the panel.
Good morning, everyone. I don't know why the number of people rarely fits the number of the size of the table, but let me begin by reading something to you, please, and hopefully you can set the tone. It is only a matter of time before an avian flu virus, most likely H5N1, acquires the ability to be transmitted from human to human, sparking the outbreak of a human pandemic, influenza. We don't know when this will happen, but we do know that it will happen. This was not some casual observer of this growing phenomenon. This was from Dr. Li Jianwuk, who is the director of the World Health Organization. And I am hard-pressed to find when people in the public arena speak with such strident language and assertiveness. And that is what drew our organization to the discussion about avian influenza. I'm delighted to be asked to moderate this session because it's an imperative one. It's so important. And with great respect to Don, we have a slightly different view about people, and we're more inclined to agree with the Times article, and that reference was pertaining to a member of the financial services industry. Sometimes you can't make this stuff up. Yesterday I was with a company, everyone in this room knows the name of this company, and I couldn't get arrested talking about avian influenza with this organization. So I'm delighted to hear that there are areas where we've made significant progress. There's a lot of places, a lot more work that needs to be done. Plus, you always know when you're working on a hot topic when it's in the newspaper. As indicated earlier, the Wall Street Journal, the New York Times, we've talked about, and then we have the financial institutions and their service providers supply essential financial services and as such should consider their preparedness and response strategy for a potential pandemic. That is the quote from the Federal Reserve yesterday. Do you have any idea how much it costs to coordinate the release of all three for today's session? I just think that's marvelous. We are going to be talking about preparedness. And what I'd like to suggest is that we follow a format already well established by the White House, and that is the discussion about avian in three major segments, and probably two out of the three, given the time we have. Preparedness, the second section was surveillance and detection, and the third section pertained to response and containment. Gentlemen, we're going to be looking for very action-oriented language. I think Don said it best. We are really entering into a new phase. We need not hit the mule over the head with the 2x4 because most reasonable people now recognize the potential for this situation. So it's time to move on to very action-oriented, you know, transitive verbs we're looking for here. Sister Mary Ellen would be very proud of me right now. But really specific advice with tasks certain and with completion dates certain seem to be most helpful to the people that we interact with. So with that, I'd like to invite Alton, and then we'll work our way closer this direction, just to begin with some opening comments, some observations, and looking for those nuggets that we can walk away with today from this collaborative session. Let me invite Alton to begin with your opening comments. Do you want to hit the microphone there, please?
Well, let me just add the usual bureaucratic caveat I always have to give, and that is I work for the Securities and Exchange Commission, and as a matter of commission policy, the commission disclaims any responsibility for any private statement by any SEC staff member, and the remarks express my own views and do not necessarily reflect the views of the commission or my colleagues. All right, that's out of the way. As a regulator, we perhaps get a rather skewed perspective on this because one of the issues that comes up inevitably is regulatory relief or regulatory forbearance in most of the world. Let me just cover that for very quickly. We really believe that with proper planning, the markets can keep open, even in the most severe pandemic. They did in 1918, you know. Truncated hours sometimes, but they were able to maintain operations, and the markets were not nearly, they were not electronic at that point. And so we think this is doable. And we think the planning is starting. Actually, it's going forward rather well. And we have a history as regulators of granting regulatory relief when it's absolutely necessary. We issued a number of exemptions and interpretations after 9/11, after Katrina. So I think regulators have a good track record of working with the industry to help them stay open. And we also recognize that most plans call for telecommuting or operating from dispersed locations. That said, I think it's also important to recognize that while we will try to keep the markets open, I believe the markets will remain open, we're not ready to sacrifice necessarily those protections that have been built into the markets over the last 50-plus years. Those include supervision, record-keeping, price transparency. Now, with the proper planning and preparation, it would not be necessary to give up those. Sorry, if it's not working? All right. With the proper planning and preparation, it's not necessary to give up those protections. And if I were going to leave you with one message, and it's the message we've been giving the industry in this area, is that that contemplating regulatory relief should be one of the pieces of preparing for a pandemic, but probably should be one of the last pieces. In essence, regulatory relief should not be viewed as a substitute for adequate planning and preparation. Once the firms, once the organizations have been able to work out plans to say, we're going to do this, we're going to have these systems set up so that people can operate from home, and yet there are going to be records kept, their risk managers will be able to know what their positions are, their compliance people will keep an eye on them. There will be price transparency that investors have come to rely on. And here are a few areas where we might need some help from the regulators. Some of the regulations we might not be able to fulfill, but here's a request for an specific exemption for a very limited period of time. That's when you really get the best reception from your regulators. And I believe that that process is now undergoing.
Thanks so much. Stephen, can we invite your 1 or 2 minute comments?
Just a couple of points I would open with. We believe that the avian flu threat can, in fact, be addressed within the context of business continuity planning. An awful lot of effort, what I'm holding here is the business continuity planning document from the Federal Financial Institutions Examination Council. This is available on the FFIEC website. And if you read this, this includes the exam program that we undertake when, in fact, we go into an institution. This was revised post 9/11. It was published March 2003, as indeed is, in fact, what we use on examinations. What we articulated in our guidance yesterday, and I see Jim Devlin here from the OCC, it was the Fed, the OCC, the FDIC, and Office of Thrift Supervision. That's four of the five agencies that consist that make up the FFIEC, issued this guidance yesterday. It was referred to, and indeed, it simply alerts financial institutions that they need to address the avian flu threat within the context of business continuity planning, and an awful lot of effort and time, much of it articulated by my colleagues, Don, for example, has gone into that document. Now, there are things that make the avian flu threat different, and I think Don articulated those well. The scale effects, that is national, international, and scale, the duration effects. Normally, as we've thought about events, terrorist event happens, can happen without warning. A hurricane, you might have 3 days, 2 days, and then it's over after 5 days. So the duration effects are different with the pandemic. And those issues have to be addressed. Essentially, we're talking here about a labor and an employee absentee and a productivity problem in the end. Let me say a few words. In addition to dealing with the resilience, that is operations risk of the financial infrastructure, we have to think of potential market effects and then finally macroeconomic effects, supply-demand type shocks. As with other aspects of the avian flu, the effects on financial markets are highly uncertain and vary with specific details regarding the progress, the intensity, and the duration of an actual pandemic. Anticipatory effects in the markets could intensify and accelerate the economic effects. That is, most of the scenarios that we are dealing with are a moderate scenario and then an extreme scenario, the 1918. The extreme scenario parallels the 1918 Spanish flu. Clearly, financial markets will likely require higher risk premiums and volatility, but again, it's very difficult to predict. One of the things I would like to pass on, the question then becomes, what do we know about past pandemics and the market effects? Let me just, this is some research that's been done. Back in March of 1918, the Dow Jones Industrial Average was at $78.05 in March. It climbed to $81.95 in August. You're right, if only we had invested $500. The worst of the pandemic hit the United States in September through December, but the stock market virtually ignored the staggering number of people infected and high death toll. The Dow Jones Industrial Average hit 82.5 in September, $86.25 in October, and $84 in November. Another, of course, incident that we can look at market effects was the SARS outbreak in 2003. And, of course, in that case, the two most affected areas were Southeast Asia and Canada. In these cases, too, it is difficult to discern an adverse impact on stock values. During the second quarter of 2003, which was the peak for the SARS outbreak, the Toronto Stock Exchange Index rose strongly, though more slowly than the S&P 500 in the U.S. The Shanghai Composite was slightly down for the quarter, but the Hang Seng Index rose nearly as fast as the S&P with about a one-month lag. I think the bottom line is that at the very least, the conventional, quote-unquote, wisdom that an outbreak of avian flu influenza will lead to financial market collapse is suspect. We simply don't know. We can look at past behavior and observe. I think there is something that's different. This was alluded to in the modern age of communications. We're going to be dealing with the TV effects. We'll go through a period, if there's human-to-human transmission, when we'll have to respond, and this is why communications planning is so important, to the TV effects, because the commentators may choose to talk about the 1918. We won't know what the severity at the first outbreak. Is this a moderate? Is this severe? Does it look like something that happened in the 70s and 80s, or does it look like 1918? That won't be known. In other words, initially, casualty rates won't be known, but one can imagine the commentators talking about a worst-case scenario. That's going to create uncertainty both for people and markets and institutions. And I think a real challenge for us is to continue as was noted, communications is one of the key focuses of the national effort, and I think that's key for all of us to think about that. We're going to need to work very hard to communicate and get accurate information to the public.
Perhaps we can drill down on some of those issues in a moment. Yes. Then, Greg, how's our money?
It's very well protected.
Okay.
I'm very familiar with the FFIEC document as a member of the Office of Business Continuity at Citigroup. It's essentially our Bible as to how we govern ourselves in terms of business continuity. Citigroup has always had business continuity plans to cover a wide range of threat scenarios, from fires to earthquakes to floods, things of that nature. With respect to avian influenza, Citigroup formed a task force to deal with the issue, bringing together many of our support disciplines and partnering with our businesses in order to figure out what is it that we need to do in order to – I'm sorry. As I was saying, Citigroup has put together a task force to figure out what it is that we need to do in order to minimize the risk of introducing the virus into the workplace, which has been the mission of our group. And we've been working on this for several months, and we've engaged in about 8 different areas that we've been looking at in terms of avian influenza. And one of the things running a program for a large multinational corporation is that it's not just a domestic issue in terms of U.S. We have to be very sensitive to local cultures, other governments, regulations, and coming up with a common set of guidelines and triggers that can ensure consistency with what we do, but taking into account local laws, regulation, and culture as well. Some of those areas that we are looking at are some of the things that have already been spoken about, communications. We're looking at various human resource issues, making sure that if something does happen that employees aren't disadvantaged in the workplace, looking at the potential use of antiviral medications, looking at our continuity of business plans or crisis management triggers. What are we going to do, or what are the triggers that we're going to set up that we'll guide our actions by? And we'll generally be following the triggers set forth by the World Health Organization, their phases 1 through 6, and once again allowing for local governments or local cultures, should they have an escalation process that's different, or if it's a cultural issue, we'll react accordingly to that as well. And the program is still ongoing, and it just incorporates what our corporate philosophy is in terms of our shared responsibilities to our customers, our shareholders, and to our fellow employees.
In a few minutes, we'll challenge how collaborative and open those in the private sector are when we ask for some particulars, not only from you, but from our friend Gerald. At AIG, what are you seeing, Gerald? Trend analysis here.
There's a lot of similarity. I mean, I think some of the things we're doing are probably fairly common. And we started about 6 months ago. And I think at that time, there weren't a lot of people focused on this issue. And I'm very pleased to see now that there's a lot of attention on this issue. There's a lot of places you can go for information and coordination sharing and that kind of thing that was not there 6 months ago. The biggest challenge for us is the size of our organization and its and where we do business. We have about 93,000 people, half of whom are scattered around 130 countries and jurisdictions around the world. So, you know, following up on Greg's point, we have to be very mindful not only of our workforce in the United States, but in all these various countries and jurisdictions. We started off three fundamental objectives. One, to protect our employees, those 93,000 people that are out there, in some in very high-risk areas. The second, basically, to maintain the continuation, continuity of our businesses, and very importantly, to maintain the capability of servicing our clients. That was our second objective. And the third was to absolutely make sure we understand what our own business exposures are. Now, AIG underwrites insurance in a number of lines of business, and I think the one that's probably going to be affected most by this is the life business and the accident and health business that we write in Asia. We are doing some extensive modeling and research in order to come up with some reliable figures. There's a lot of sensational numbers out there in the press, and, but we needed something a little much more reliable in terms of just how. I mean, you just can't always cite the 1918 impact in order to come up with some conclusions for today. So we're very, very heavily into doing that. We started as a top-down approach, buy-in by the board, chairman all the way down. I put together a committee, a corporate infectious disease committee, in our corporate headquarters in New York. And we had mirror images of that, and we divided the world up into 10 regions. Each of those regions has a regional infectious disease committee, and they are responsible for helping us get ready at a lot of these locations. One interesting part of this is what we did was something that had not been done in AIG before. AIG is very much organized along lines of business, but as Don mentioned, this is going to be a locational risk. This is one in which we may have a building in Hong Kong that has the life business and the general insurance business and the personal lines insurance business. So if each of those is making their own plans, it could be not as efficient as having a locational or regional-based plan. And that's precisely what we did. We had to grind it out. But I think after 6 months, we are now organized along geographic lines, which is much more efficient. We've had to rewrite the playbook insofar as human resources issues are concerned, HR issues, business continuity issues, IT, security, you name it, facilities management. All of those policies and guidelines we had, some apply, some don't. Business continuity, we decided to totally revamp to take into account the risks of a pandemic. And we're still at it. We are in the midst now of testing our business continuity plans through tabletop exercises and elsewhere. I just came back from Asia, where we concentrated our efforts. We felt that that was the front line in Tokyo, Shanghai, Hong Kong, and they're just about through testing their business continuity plans, again, on regional bases. We're very concerned about what foreign governments are going to do. And part of your planning has to take into account what they're going to do. So we have encouraged, and I think we're doing well in maintaining liaison, local public health authorities, government authorities, embassies, consulates around the world. And you know, your plan for Indonesia may be different than your plan for Singapore. Each country is going to react in a different way, and you need to know what that is as best as you can in order that you could adjust your plan accordingly.
Thank you very much. Scott, the view from the Treasury, please. You want to move that microphone?
Well, good morning. Thanks so much for being here. The Center for Strategic and International Studies and Ann Solomon, you know, the fact that we're here this morning, I think, demonstrates some of the leadership that goes on and a lot of exemplifies a lot of the thinking that's actually going on, not just here in this country, but worldwide. We see colleagues from Hong Kong and other places out here in the audience today. I think that's great. One thing, though, that I have to say, Ken, is that my eighth grade English teacher, who taught me sentence diagramming, would be so proud to know that my career has evolved to the point where I sit on a panel and the instruction is use transitive verbs. She must be greatly proud wherever she is. There's a lot to be said. There's a lot that's already been said. Let me just try to make a couple of quick observations and we'll get on with it. You ask for action. There's been a tremendous amount of action within this administration, within the federal government. The president has made this a national priority. His budget request is for $7.1 million to address various aspects of not only avian flu, but of pandemics in general. Some of those spending priorities include detection and containment, a new way to develop vaccines that uses a cell culture instead of the current egg culture that we have, money for new treatments and vaccines, money for HHS to both develop and stockpile vaccines and antiviral medications, government preparedness. Is a significant focus of our government right now, and I'm pleased to tell you that there has been tremendous progress. One of the things that we've done at the federal level is we've organized for disaster, and as you heard Don say in his opening remarks, there are 17 sectors that are represented across the government, and each of those sectors has a lead federal agency that works in close collaboration to prepare that sector, to address common concerns. At Treasury, we are primarily concerned with banking and finance. That is our role. We are the lead agency. And we think about not only the banking and finance as a sector unto itself, but we think about its enabling effect on our economy. We are experiencing tremendous growth. Our economy is very strong right now. But we want to make sure that we can identify early any threats to the economy. And certainly an efficient, functioning, orderly financial system is a key to any successful economy, and it's an absolute essential necessity for continued economic growth. So as a result, we are working very hard and in close collaboration with the private sector. I would just add a couple of more things real quick, and we can move on. You know, the president's leadership on this has been strong. There was a cabinet-level exercise that was conducted back in December of this past year to address the issue of pandemics, of avian flu, and how we would respond. There have been multiple sessions since then, and I guess I would just tell you that if you're in the audience today and you want to know what is the federal government doing to address this issue, I would just say that we are doing quite a bit.
Very good. Before Don provides a follow-up on a matter raised earlier, I'm just going to advise those on the panel we're going to have the next round looking for action items, but not just commencement of items, completion of items, and a date that you would recommend that act to be completed by. Don, you had a follow-up?
Get that mic.
You get the microphone.
Yeah. Yeah, I did want to follow up on the New York Times issue. It's actually wonderful that you asked that question, because the person, as Ken indicated, it was a financial services person who made that comment. It was actually Deutsche Bank out of the Frankfurt office. Deutsche Bank, New York, hosted an industry meeting on the morning of September 23rd, 2005, where they invited, I just looked it up, where they invited people from the significant firm population and from the industry infrastructure population expressly to talk about avian flu preparations. Okay? Deutsche Bank at the time was way out ahead of everybody else, and they said, guys, we need to make sure you understand what this issue is. And they spent a morning taking everyone through it and sharing information among financial firms as to what the nature of the issue was and how people were thinking about the issue at that time. And obviously that was in the very, very early stages. So it's actually an interesting validation of the fact that the sector is very good about sharing information among the sector. I'm going to go on and tell you the metric of my willingness to share information and collaborate with my peers in the sector about how to deal with this issue is not my willingness to have my plan published on the front page of the New York Times. Okay? The Times called me and said, tell us the details of your plan. I would probably answer, I'm not willing to share that information with the press. But it is something that there's a very, very extensive, and you've heard that reference several times, practice within the community of sharing peer-to-peer, and that certainly will continue.
Great. Thank you so much for that clarification. It seems the challenges of communication are not confined to post-pandemic eras, so we need to work on that, I guess. I'd like to turn our attention now, as I said, to action items. I believe that we're at a point in the avian influenza discussion of establishing that this could be a concern, and we don't carry the burden here this morning of identifying whether or not will occur. We do carry the burden, though, of getting ready in the event that it does occur. Greg, I'd like to begin with you, please, if we could. And the question is, if you were specifically advising those in your industry, what are the most important tasks you would identify and kindly indicate when they should be completed, by which point they should be completed?
I would say that the most important task with this project, as with many other recovery projects or any other recovery situation, is definitely communications and setting up the appropriate infrastructure to make sure that you can get the right information to the right people at the right time. That has been probably the pillar of our project in terms of getting ready for avian flu, or not even just avian flu, for pandemic preparedness. It could be H5N1 today or something mm-hmm. else 5 years from now. And you have to be sure you have the appropriate processes in place so you can just pull them off the shelves and institutionalize them.
So have a communications package completed by when?
As soon as you can. We've already completed most of our communications initiatives. We've set up, I'll give you a few examples. In terms of communicating to employees, we've set up an internal avian flu website. Citigroup is very fortunate in that it has its own internal medical staff. So on our avian flu website, in terms of communication, we've been emphasizing the importance of hygiene and education in terms of educating yourself to the virus and what types of hygiene protocols you can take in terms of the appropriate washing of hands, even coughing, making sure that your food is cooked at a certain temperature, mm-hmm. Things of that nature, just some of the basics, which is probably the right emphasis at this point.
Would you declare that to be necessary as a completion act in 2006?
Yes, definitely.
Gerald?
Yep, I agree with that.
You want to hit your microphone there?
Pardon?
Oh, I'm sorry.
We put a lot of attention on communications, too. We view it as a dynamic. There's really no end to it.
Right.
And it's primarily directed we have a public communication strategy, but what we spend more time on is internal communications in the form of FAQs, and we send these out regularly to our employees. Here's what you do in an emergency. Here's who you contact, and so far we too put an intranet site up on avian flu where all employees can get access to it. On that, we've posted our guidelines for what kinds of dispensers to use. Posters. We produce posters in Chinese, Japanese, local languages that are posted around the hallways and office ways and restrooms. in some of these locations. So communications, and I hear feedback from our committees around the world. Employee communications is the one that they view as the most important. But I don't see an end to it. But the essential ingredients of the plan ought to be in there, certainly in 2006. And we're using – the website is terrific. I don't know how we'd get all this information out without that.
Yeah.
And we're posting up on there now. You know, we follow the WHO stages as well, you know, stage 3 through 6. And we're in 3, of course. And we worked it now so that a manager in Hong Kong can go into that intranet site and on the home page, click on phase 3, and up will pop a menu of issues that he should be concerned about: medical, HR, communications, local liaison, antivirals, all that. And he will know by clicking again, maybe 2 or 3 clicks, he could pretty much understand what he should have completed during this phase 3. And we're using phase 4 as a trigger for him to go to the next column on the home page and click phase 4. And if he's in an affected country, he does this. If he's in a non-affected country, he does that. And we developed some policies that that the 3 to 4 unaffected is kind of a window of opportunity to start considering evacuation of non-critical staff, dependents, and so forth, from overseas anyway, back home to the United States. Because when you get into phase 4 affected, it probably is not going to be possible.
Ken, could I also interject that to follow up on those comments as well as Don's comments? The communication plans at in the private and public sector also have to concern themselves with external parties. It's vital to know what your local city, state health authorities are going to do. You need to work out those arrangements now. And I know in New York, Chicago, various financial centers, they're actively involved in that.
So have those dialogues now,
yes.
Create those relationships now.
In addition, there are established protocols where there are conference calls where the continuity managers at the various firms will be talking to each other. As Don indicated, the power outage in 2003 was a perfect example. So those arrangements have already been made. If you're asking for an action item, that's in the past tense. Those are already in place.
Okay.
You also have to have communication plans internationally. And just to follow up on that, I've had the pleasure of working with a group under the Joint Forum, where you had financial authority people from about a dozen jurisdictions working on a paper which I think was handed out on a high level, principles for business continuity. And one of the keys there is communication, and I'm happy to say that the group that created that document is continuing to talk so that if there is an event in one part of the world, we can talk to each other and get a better sense of what are you doing to respond to that, what's working, what's not working, that type of thing. I think you can't limit your communications plans to your employees. That's critical. But you also have to reach out, if you are a business, to your suppliers, to your customers, to the public in general.
Right. Don, a task certain with a date certain, apart from what you've heard already?
Well, I think what I've heard is kind of underscoring an issue that people are really struggling with, which is, we all remember swine flu, okay? And we all remember that there was a very public, the world, the sky is falling in the 1970s around swine flu, and the sky remained firmly in place. And so people are certainly mindful of the fact that there's a question about if this is going to happen. And hearing statements by the Secretary of HHS or the statement you read earlier that a pandemic is coming is sort of, okay, we all understand that, but that doesn't necessarily mean that this is the one. So I think what we can usefully do is differentiate between things that have utility under any circumstance and things that are very, A, expensive, and, B, are particularly directed against this specific incident, and view that as a boundary line. Things that are in the first category are probably immediate priorities. Things that are in the second category, I think we are saying you're waiting for some trigger event, and that needs to happen before you would expect people to move into that stage. Perfect example I mentioned earlier. Some of the trading firms are thinking about having people trade from home and thinking about establishing trading turrets in people's houses. Very expensive thing to do. Everyone is saying, I'm not going there now because I don't know if I'm going to need to do this. The kinds of things that Jerry and Greg talked about are things that are immediate issues because they are useful immediately and useful currently, and certainly people should be moving ahead with that. I think the one thing I would add to their list is identifying the triggering stages to move into various levels of preparedness. For example, what is the triggering event that is going to make you say, I'm putting a trading turret in people's houses, to use that example? And thinking through that issue now, again, many of our institutions are taking as key components of their strategies that they want to have a substantial work-from-home capability. That means you got to put in broadband connections in people's houses. You have to take all those steps. I think thinking through and determining what are the triggering events that make you move from, you know, phase A of your plan to phase B of your plan is also something that people can be taking as an 06 deliverable, and making sure that they have that structure pretty well mapped out, I would say, by mid-06. That's something that people probably need to really think through fairly quickly, because the lead time on some of that stuff is pretty extensive.
Yeah, if your trigger is the declaration of a pandemic, it's probably too late.
Oh, you're way too late by that.
Well,
not going to happen.
If I might, I think that's a very important point. One thing that we've done is we've taken the WHO stages and mapped them to the U.S. government stages, and then tried to anticipate what a world-wide reaction might be from public health authorities and the like, and then from that map to our own actions, whether it's to go ahead and stand up additional telecommuting or separate the workforce. But I think that we found very helpful to map the WHO stages, the U.S. government stages, what the likely effects would be, and then what, you know, we as an institution would do.
So what would that one item be from your perspective, from your agency's perspective?
You mean a triggering event?
No, a task certain with a completion date certain.
Oh, I would agree with Don.
Yeah.
I think the financial sector, my own perspective from talking with lots of people, is that the financial sector is generally out in the lead, and I think the having a first cut at a plan by June, I mean, that's already in the works, and we're on a trajectory, I believe, generally, we're on a trajectory, certainly the largest systemically critical institutions are, to accomplish that. Now, that plan is going to have to evolve as
sure.
more information becomes available.
But would you go so far as to say the absence of a plan by mid-year would be equivalent to putting that organization at risk?
Let me add the Alton caveat. My comments do not represent those necessarily.
Hey, you guys are witnesses. I tried.
When you talk about risk, you have to, of course, be specific. Are you talking about risk to the institution's employees, to the institution, to the institution's counterparties, or more generally to the financial system? I would think it would be prudent to have a first draft of a plan that addresses the issues that we've been discussing here today, certainly by this summer.
Sure. Scott, let's assume that you've read the disclaimer.
Trust me, I've read that disclaimer.
Yes, I'm sure. But again, in this prescriptive mode that we're in, some actions very laser beam specific with dates certain.
Well, I think what you've heard already, the notion of having a plan, I think by mid-year is a reasonable requirement. When I say requirement, I think it's a responsibility that businesses should have. I don't think it should be a regulatory requirement necessarily. Mm-hmm. I think it should complement the existing business continuity plans that are already in place. If you look at the financial sector, I might add, Ken, one thing that's very interesting to me is we've there is a tremendous amount of information sharing, and we're actually seeing situations where counterparties to one firm will come in and actually ask to see their trading partners' business continuity plans for avian flu and a host of other situations that they may be facing. That's a really positive thing. That is, in effect, it's sort of an audit of you're making a judgment. Is my counterparty, do I have risk here? And if I do, I'm going to need to take action to mitigate that risk. I find that tremendously efficient. And that is, it's creating a cascading effect that goes across the industry that really encourages investment into these things. But I would caution, I want to caution very strongly, and it's something that Don mentioned, it's not clear to me at this point in time that there's a single one-size-fits-all solution to your business continuity planning for this event. Certainly work at home is one option. But there may be other options. You may be in a situation where you can split workforces. There are things to be considered there.
Very good. Very good.
Can I throw
Don, please.
I'm going to throw another one in. And I am not trying to put the people on the panel on the spot, because I don't think this is their issue. One of the things that I think is also a mid-06 deliverable, hopefully mid-06, is more clarity from the governmental authorities who are going to be responsible for the public sector response here. And I'm not really talking the financial side. I'm talking the public health side. I'm talking the infrastructure protection side, DHS, HHS. I think I'm in that space. One of the key concerns we have is that there will be a lot of local responses to the unfolding of this event if it occurs, and it's going to be almost a free-for-all as to how it gets addressed. And at minimum, we have to have some national way of knowing what different localities are doing in response to this, so that there is some consolidated way of knowing what areas are quarantined, if anyone takes that step, what areas are doing, the snow day equivalent, what other steps are being taken in particular localities, so that there, people who are national institutions or global institutions have some sense of what's happening in the 50 states. And that
towards what end, though, Don?
Because I think we need to know, what am I supposed to be doing in individual locations? If I have people there, if I have, a business operation there, if, our business site is in Tampa, I need to know what Tampa is doing. And I need to have a sense of how that locality is going to be addressing this issue. And I think when you take it up to the sector level, I think the sector as a whole needs a consolidated way of dealing with that. And obviously the lead time on that is going to be extensive. That's something I would hope the public sector would be starting in motion, because I think that's an instrumentality we would need in this eventuality if it occurs.
If I could depart from my role as moderator for a moment, I would like to throw one in there, and that is the question and the issues that have been raised by Don and some others. First of all, I think there's a lot of value in departing from the belief that history is prologue, invoking the 1918 example, I'm not sure is fair. This is the first pandemic of the information age. I would love to see Ed Whitaker, Ivan Seidenberg, Dwayne Ackerman, and Dick Notabart before Congress answering the following question, yes or no. If people are confined to their homes and therefore have to conduct business via your networks, are your networks ready, as Don said, to take care of that last mile? Yes or no? We need to know that. We need to know that now if we're going to sustain the activity in the economy. I'm going to provide a warning to the those in the public sector. We're going to move to the private sector participants and ask them to convey a question to one of you. What's been burning? What's been unanswered? What has not been adequately addressed, what has not been addressed at all? What would you ask of those organizations represented by people here today, assuming that we have all read the disclaimer. You want to start, Craig?
I would have to say that a week ago I would have had a lot more questions than I would have had than I have now.
Why is that?
As a Citigroup, we did have challenges in trying to figure out how governmental agencies would be speaking with each other during a time of crisis. Just speaking from an international perspective, we know that certain governments, the local health ministries, have just as much influence as the financial authorities, and their rules and regulations are just as binding upon us. And you have to plan for, if you're going to split your operations site, what happens if the local health ministry comes down and closes your backup site? How are you going to handle that? From a planning perspective, you have to have a range of options available to you in order to account for those types of scenarios. So I'm encouraged to hear that our governmental authorities are in this dialogue with other agencies around the globe and here domestically as well. The other challenge that we at Citigroup had, we talk a lot about, is the telco remote access issues, where governments or countries that may not have as robust an infrastructure as the United States or maybe some of the Western European nations, for example, how are they planning if they have perhaps maybe one or two telco lines in their infrastructure and they have a large percentage of their domestic population working from home? How are they planning for that? I'm encouraged to hear that we're having these conversations here, but our local, is there anything that our governmental leaders can help us in terms of encouraging that dialogue internationally?
Gerald, any questions for those representing their respective agencies?
Nothing terribly different.
Your microphone.
From what you've heard, I think information. There's a lot out there, and I think reliable information. My whole career has been dealing with information and making sure it's as accurate as possible for people who have to make key decisions. So there's a lot out there that needs to be sorted through. The other is what you mentioned, coordinate, or what Don mentioned, coordination, to making sure there's some understanding of what's going on with the various states and local and jurisdictions are doing within the United States. But I would, from our point of view, extend that to international. I mentioned it earlier. I'm absolutely critical that the United States government, the UHO, and the WHO persist in working with foreign governments for a variety of reasons, and it goes into prevention and containment and response, all of those areas we're talking about. Some governments are more open than others. Some governments are more prepared to respond to a crisis than others. I think we need to keep after them, particularly in the critical areas, and that would be a role that the federal government can really help private sector with, particularly those of us who have significant assets and significant presence all around the world. And it bears directly on how we will respond. How assured are we that our employees, our expatriates, will have fair and equal access to medical facilities, to antivirals, to vaccines? There has to be a continuing effort on the part of our embassies or our government, maybe through the embassies, consulates, travels. I know a lot of our senior government officials travel throughout these countries to keep after this and encourage more transparency on the part of some of these high risk zones that are around the world. And then I would say development of the vaccine, of course, is maybe the silver bullet in all this, but there must be a way in which we can accelerate the production of a vaccine. I realize we can't start on a vaccine until we have the final number of what this H5N1 looks like, but there must be a better way to produce it than the current way. So I hope there's a lot of work going on in that.
Don, any specifics?
Well, I think Jerry and Greg kind of implicitly made the point very clear that our a lot of our hardest questions are not to the financial regulators.
Right.
They're to other branches of government. And there are a lot of information needs that we would have that we would be looking to other branches of government to satisfy. And I think Jerry and Greg ticked them off very, very effectively. In terms of the financial regulators, I think the only concrete thing I can think of right now is what's the process for coming to grips with the issue of
regulatory relief, and how do we start to get some clarity, or what is the process to getting some clarity around that? Because, again, that's going to be a key planning variable that we need to have more detail about. Again, I keep harping on this example of people trading from home, but there are all kinds of supervisory issues that that raises. There are all kinds of other regulatory implications. You know, how do you timestamp things when you're sitting in front of, you know, sitting in front of a turret in your living room? I mean, all that kind of detail. And it's not so much what are the answers, but what is the process we need to follow to get those answers with greater clarity sometime, I think, in 06, again, is something that we'd hope to have a better feel for by the end of the year. And, again, I know there's a lot of fuzziness in that, but getting some greater clarity around that during the year would be very helpful.
That's an elegant segue, then. We've talked about preparedness for the most part. Let's talk about response after the fact. And given your views of the likely state of readiness across a number of domains affecting this industry, let me start with Alton. Will we be trading in a post-environment where a pandemic is declared, we have millions of people affected, either as caregivers or infected, and approaching to the point rapidly where transportation and other interactions by people will be restricted by government mandate? Do we trade?
I think, as I said earlier, I believe with the proper planning, yes, we do, because we're going to have to. We really have no choice. You know, it's one thing for the telecommunications to bring the markets to a halt for 4 days. 6 to 8 weeks, that's simply unworkable. We will work around it. We'll work with the industry to work around it. The markets will trade. Those issues of regulatory relief are solvable. A dialogue is already going on. I think to some extent the lawyers came to this a little bit late. The business continuity people and the IT people at the firms have been, to my knowledge, been working actively in this area for quite a while. It's now that the legal departments are beginning to wake up and make sure that they have the right systems in place to maintain those record-keeping, supervision, you know, price transparency requirements. That's going to happen, and that process is going on now.
With regard to that activity, then, again, this is a scenario we all hope never occurs. Have you arrived, your agency arrived at the conclusion of how you would address the post-pandemic declared environment from a compliance perspective, oversight perspective? Do you have those plans ready at the SEC on how your agency's performance would change in the wake of a pandemic?
Are you talking about our internal planning?
Yes.
Are you talking?
All
right. Yes, we're going through the same exercise, I believe, that the industry is going through and every other agency. I know the president has asked the agencies to have their own plans in order by the end of this month, and I believe we'll be very far along. I think we have that well into hand, and it's the same issues that you're raising with all the others. You also have to make a very thorough, fresh analysis of what your critical operations are. As Don said, well, you know, a critical operation, something that you might be able to skip for a week, you might not be able to skip for 6 to 8 weeks. And you have to then figure out who are the key staff you need in place to keep those operations going. And are they set up to maintain those operations from remote locations? Let me add one additional feature. And I know a lot of the private sector firms are basing their plans on the World Health Organization phases. One thing to keep in mind is raised in the PHYSIC document. You also have to plan for the ratcheting down after the pandemic. No one's going to ring a bell and say the pandemic's over. It's going to gradually fade. And do you bring all your people back at the same time? Do you bring back a few people to a facility, you know, and you stagger it? How does that interact with your succession plans? You know, do you necessarily have all three of your top executives return to the facility at the same time, or do you stagger that out?
So this would be another example of an action item to be completed.
And it's something that's not immediately apparent if you're fixating on simply the World Health Organization scale, because that's looking at it from the point of view of public health. And yeah. This is a matter of how do you bring business back gradually back to normal.
Stephen, does the FOMC still meet?
Yes. In fact, the FOMC can and has in the past met by conference call.
And ongoing monetary policy determination is unimpeded?
Well,
is the assumption,
monetary policy, of course, has to be adjusted to what's happening within the economy. Monetary policy would be cognizant, of course, of the macro supply and demand shocks that are going on.
But if we have a situation, as Don was highlighting, that you might not know all the things you need to know in order to identify what that policy change, if necessary, should be, are there any provisions that you've explored on how to get the information that's necessary?
Well, we have in our broader contingency planning, post 9/11, there was some 40 tasks that we initiated, as my colleagues have indicated. We have done a lot of planning over the years to deal with acts of nature in the run-up to Y2K. A lot of planning was done that actually proved valuable on 9/11. And those scenarios, as I indicated, have effects that one might find in something like a pandemic. And, of course, we rely on various sources of information, and we may have to do some information substitution as an input.
Right.
But of course, as with any critical function in the government, the expectation is that we would continue to operate. Let me say just a word about the regulatory relief issue. I think Katrina is a good example. I think when you talk about regulatory relief, you can think in advance about what you might do. And indeed, the agencies that supervise federal depositories have provided regulatory relief in a number of situations. A permissible close, for example, by the controller of the currency, state banking authorities, and that kind of thing. If the question is, are we prepared to address regulatory relief? The answer is, we think in advance. We take a look at what we've done in the past, but we also have to be flexible. And if you look at what we did during Katrina, you'll find that we had a response that was, if you talk to the bankers in the affected area and the state banking superintendents will tell you that we had a response that was both responsible and to the extent that we had to modify what we would have done otherwise, we did that based on the circumstances at that time. Again, planning can be done, but you also have to have flexibility to adapt based on the circumstances at the time, given the fact that uncertainty is almost endless.
What kind of certainty, again, owing to Don's question. What type of certainty could we expect by the end of the year on likely areas of regulatory relief? Do you anticipate that clarity being a 2006 event?
Well, first of all, the agencies, as Alton and Don have indicated, the agencies that are responsible for supervising the financial system have work underway, starting again with their basic continuity planning, in which a large investment has been made, adapting the new threat. The avian flu, again, has characteristics that we've talked about today that are different: scale, duration, social isolation. So thinking is well underway about how this threat is different. And then, as planning to deal with that threat moves forward, these issues about how we operate, not what's critical — we can build on that already, we know it's critical — but how this threat is different as institutions plan, as my colleagues in the private sector have said, issues will then develop, for example, letting traders operate from home, and then the regulatory authorities, those are brought to our attention through our working relationship, the committees that are mentioned here today, on the one hand, address the private sector side, and the other hand, the public sector side, we share information. And the point is, as these issues are raised, and again, this trading at home is a good example, then the agency that's primarily responsible, or the agencies that are responsible, will think through it and develop a response. My point is that this is an ongoing process, okay, and we can't really get to the end of this process until we have general consensus on what these scenarios are going to, threat scenarios are going to look like, and what the plans are. The plans, in the course of planning, will raise the issues like additional regulatory forbearance planning, sure, that needs to be done.
Scott, how do we keep the banks open in this type of horrific environment?
How long do I have to answer that question?
I mean, as a practical matter, though, I mean, what are some of the realities that you're anticipating and the workarounds that you have to undertake?
Well, certainly we've already heard there are a number of forecasts as to what would happen if we have avian flu. There's the notion that we'll have significant absenteeism. There's a notion that, you know, what is the impact on mass transportation? We saw in New York City in December of this past year a transit strike that significantly diminished the ability of people to get to work, yet people found a way. I had an interesting conversation, by the way, with a team that went through the SARS crisis. And, again, this assumption about absenteeism has been central to all of our thinking. Yet what they told me is they had split into different groups, and they found that as the days dragged on with SARS, the people who were at home became sort of depressed, for lack of a better word. And the desire to get back in the workforce, to get back into some normality, was significant. So maybe absenteeism isn't as significant as we think. Look, I think what we have to do is we have to do a couple of things. One is we have to be prepared as banking and finance regulators, as stewards of the economy, to have our own agencies and our own departments be able to survive flu. The planning is well underway for that. I know at the Department of Treasury, we already have a plan, a draft plan that's being commented on, and we will adhere the president's guidance to have a plan by the end of this month. The federal government as a whole must have a plan. The president has – we actually do. We have a national strategy to combat that. And then the work that you're seeing in the banking and finance sector is going to pay tremendous dividends. We have a close collaborative relationship. The regulators are working closely with their regulated institutions. Long way of answering your questions. What do we need to do to have the banking sector, have banks open? We need to be prepared. And I would just add one caveat to that, is that preparedness is not an entirely federal issue. If we approach it that way, it's likely that someone in the chain is going to be disappointed. So if we have banks and we have financial services firms self-sufficient, then our ability to function, our financial markets, and our ability to withstand, our economy to withstand any shocks to it, is greatly enhanced.
Greg, before we go to Q&A, you get the last word. How are you keeping the banks open? Are you keeping the banks open?
As my colleagues on the panel have said before, we don't have a choice. Our customers expect us to be open. We are a large player in just about every financial instrument. We have plans in place to ensure continuity of operations for our branches. If we do have reduced an increased absenteeism, there will probably be a swing towards electronic forms of banking, increased use of ATMs, some phone-based banking or computer-based banking. And we are looking at all of these issues and are adjusting our technologies accordingly to plan for that.
Are you actually incurring expenses? Same question for Joel. Are you actually incurring expenses this year to alter your infrastructure in anticipation of the need for that?
We are incurring expenses. One of the things that I've done for my company is put together a very high-level strategic budget is what I think it's going to cost to get everything done. And that is in the process of being vetted with our senior management. Once again, it's a risk-reward, or it's a risk issue. How much risk are you willing to take versus the amount of capital you're willing to put into it? And once again, being such a large financial services institution, We can't risk not being in the marketplace.
Thank you for your candor. It's now time. We're running out of runway, so we'd like to turn our attention to questions and answers. We have a microphone, and if you'd kindly just raise your hands. Let's go in the back first, please.
Alan Schlafer with the Wharton Business School Club, and we're doing a conference covering a whole variety of these issues. I commend you all. Question is, what are your customers and the other parties? Alton, I believe you mentioned some of the things. What are they doing? What do they need to do so that they can function and benefit from all the steps that you're taking now and will be taking in the future?
Alton, you want to?
I'm not sure how you mean by customers for us. I think that's mostly directed to the private sector, although we like to think of our the firms and the organizations as customers in one fashion or another, also investors in general. Can you give me some more context on that?
Well, I think the questioner, among other things, you're looking for what works and
what the people in the private sector really are looking for from their customers, suppliers, all the third parties. There's really a matrix here that has to be considered. If you are fully prepared and the third parties are not, it's not going to make a lot of difference.
I think the key there is understanding that there will be breakdowns no matter how you plan. No matter how thoroughly you try to line up all your supplier may say that they're perfectly prepared, and then they can't get the truck driver to drive the truck from point A to point B, right. Or they try to do it and they have a quarantine at this particular bridge and can't get from point A to point B. I think the best you can do there is understand there will be breakdowns, that you have to do workarounds, you have to have alternatives in place. And if you want, if you could give one message to your customers, it's a matter of, you know, please set yourself up so you don't necessarily have to go to the bank or the broker directly if that office is closed. Can you do it from home? Can you use the telephone? Can you use online? Give yourself some flexibility. I think that's the critical element for all discussions.
Jerry, one home run that you're most proud of that represents what works.
To that question?
Yes.
I think it's absolutely critical, I understand your question, is that we understand where our critical vendors are in this process as well. You're only as strong as the weakest link. And if our critical vendors are not doing anything about this, then that'll affect us. We have a systematic program of meeting with all our critical vendors, both at the corporate level throughout the United States and overseas, and dialoguing, making sure, and looking under the covers, to make sure that they have addressed this issue, that they have viable plans in place, and that we can count on them when it's important to do so. So that is definitely a part of our business continuity planning.
And how frequently is that?
On a regular basis, it's happening now everywhere.
Great.
The other thing is we work with our clients. I mean, we talked about this article today about sharing information. We absolutely see no reason not to share. Particularly with our clients, because it's a win-win situation. If our clients do the right thing, then they're less likely to be in harm's way. We're less likely to have to pay claims. So it works as a win-win situation for us. So there's no really holds barred insofar as working with our clients, sharing information, helping them if they need help, or learning from them if we need to learn from them. And there's the only limit would be certain proprietary information, but that's minimal.
We want to try and get some more questions. Anyone else, sir, at the table there? Wait for the microphone, please.
Hi, Bill Zillia, representing Fannie Mae. A question that maybe that all employers would share is a key piece of information would be micro-detection, rapid and reliable ability to detect when an individual is in a contagious stage of one of these pandemic type of diseases versus anything else that's benign. I'm not in the medical community, so I don't know what's already available, but I think if there were focus on rapid and reliable micro detection, that would be helpful.
Maybe I could comment on that. In talking with the medical health authorities, and a number of us from FIBIC in this room have participated in discussions, one organized by Scott with the head of the National Vaccine Program. HNHS seems to have two primary thrusts in terms of, let's call it, research and development. One is just that, a rapid way to detect if you've been exposed but you're not showing symptoms. That's, you know, a large concern. I've been exposed. I'm flying in from overseas. I don't show symptoms for 2 days. If you will, some kind of an acid test that could be quickly given and easily read by health Sure. authorities, customs officials, and that. So the government has placed an emphasis on that. The second is the rapid production of vaccines that moves away from this injection into eggs, waiting some large period then to stockpile into more modern technology, VAT methods that Scott talked about. So those seem to be, I think the health authorities appreciate that those two are very important, and the information that we've received is that they are focused on both of those.
Yeah. We're familiar with certain medical companies working on infrared technology at airports, for example. As people deplane, do they emanate a higher than normal threshold of temperature reading?
But Ken, I think it's also important not to learn the wrong lessons from SARS. And again, we don't claim any medical expertise, but what we've heard from the medical experts that Steve referred to, they indicated that a flu pandemic, you have the disadvantage where people may not have obvious symptoms, right, including a temperature, for 2 days, right, and they may be infectious for more than a day during that period. And so we have to be careful not to fight the last war. We have to try to have the medical community give us guidance so that we will learn how to tailor our procedures to the current threat, not to the past threat.
Owing to the absence of a silver bullet, I think that's one of the reasons why certain people are being so assertive about the likelihood of this happening, because of the things that you just heard. There really is no silver bullet. Questions, sir?
Bill Nelson with the Financial Services Information Sharing and Analysis Center, big acronym. I think this is a question for Steve. We heard that the markets might not be impacted by pandemic of this nature, but what would the impact be on a scenario of like even a 20% infection rate, 30-35% absenteeism on the economy in terms of gross domestic product?
Very good question. Let me give you some estimates that have been made. By the way, I don't think we know what the financial market effects would be. I think what we can do is look at what happened, as I indicated, in the 1918 pandemic, how that affected the market, and then more recently the 2003 SARS. Let me give you some numbers that have been estimated. And again, estimating is very difficult because you have to, in the end, make a lot of assumptions about things like absenteeism, decline in productivity, decline in output, decline in, demand and supply. The World Bank last year estimated that a flu pandemic could cost about 2% of global GDP, or some $800 billion. In other words, a loss of $800 billion. The Congressional Budget Office report, and if you haven't read that, I'd encourage you to do that. The consulting economist Nordhaus is a macroeconomic professor at Yale and very good. And again, they had to make a lot of assumptions. They estimate that a pandemic could cost 1.5% of U.S. GDP in that moderate case scenario, and that worst case scenario that would look like 1918 could cost 5% of GDP. The Asian Development Bank estimates that Asian GDP growth could be impaired by about 2.4%. A percent in that modest or moderate estimate, and in a worst case or a Spanish flu type estimate could have a 6.5%, could shave off 6.5% of GDP. Citi, in fact, has made some estimates. They estimate if there was a 2-3% decline in the labor force, then GDP, that is the productive labor force, GDP falls by, that is U.S. GDP falls by one-half of 1% to 3%. So estimates are being made. Is there a central measure of tendency in the estimates? There's some central measure, but again, they're highly variable because the assumptions that have to be made are both broad and have a large impact.
I guess the metaphor that's invoked is things in the mirror are closer than you think.
Well, we're trying to think of another term for flight to quality now.
One last question. Where, yes, ma'am. Could you wait for the microphone, please?
Thank you. Nancy Carter Foster with the U.S. Department of State. Questions regarding evacuation planning. Although it's unlikely in many senses that a quarantine would be put in place just because of the fact that people will be shedding virus before they're actually detected to be sick. But, of course, evacuation planning is needed. Are you looking at where you might be able to evacuate your personnel outside of the United States? Because, of course, it may not be able to be possible to have people return home. And then are you also involving the transportation industry in your discussions for evacuation planning?
Evacuation. Greg, you want to take a shot at that?
Sure. Looking at issues regarding employee travel in general has been one of the things we've been looking at for the past several months now. In terms of specific evacuations, it depends. Once again, it's going to depend on the situation, the country, and what the what that country's local governments and regulators are going to say. We've had talks about how would we transfer functions from one area to another, the key processes, the people that support those processes, how would we migrate them from within the United States from perhaps one area to another, and then outside of the United States from here to maybe Europe perhaps. And some of that modeling we've done is already part of our BAU in terms of swinging certain key processes to certain offshore locations or training staff in other locations to support those types of processing. So we wouldn't necessarily have to rely on pure evacuation of people as a contingency alternative. But in terms of, in the event that we actually have to do it, we have conversations with our internal transportation folks and we're working on putting plans together as to where they would go and how would we support those key processes.
Don, in your conversations, is evacuation a topic that comes up frequently, and what are you hearing?
Well, I think we're hearing the kinds of things that Greg is describing, that firms are thinking those issues through. The only context in which I've specifically heard that issue discussed is, again, the information sharing issue of different firms wanting to understand how they are approaching that issue so that people understand, is my peer firm in the same location going to trigger evacuation under a certain point in time, and how do I plan around that? How do I think around that? So that's an issue that I would say discussions are in the very, very early stages of. But clearly, as you get more into the comparing notes across institution, you're going to have that kind of issue and many other issues come up as well.
Very good. Gentlemen, I'm afraid that's all the time we have.
Would you do me a favor and announce that this is out in the...
Yes. Been brought to my attention, Protecting the U.S. Critical Financial Infrastructure, the 2005 report in review, is available for everyone outside.
Right.
And we encourage you to pick that up. Let me just... I'm sorry?
Real quick comment?
Real, real quick. And this concludes the commercial portion of today's session. Let me just leave you with H.G. Wells, a comment. Human history becomes more and more a race between education and catastrophe. And the excellent content provided by our panelists today, I'm sure you would agree, helps make that distance between catastrophe and the absence of it a lot wider now. Please join me in thanking those panelists.